Linda, there's an apartment that you write about in your book that sounds pretty awful. Could you tell me about the place?
Yeah. It was the cheapest place we could find in Cincinnati, Ohio, last minute. So it was top of the pops as far as marble countertops and big fireplaces go. No, actually, it was this kind of dingy little basement. And the way they'd put it together, you couldn't get the oven door down all the way because they'd built a wall to create like a galley kitchen. But you couldn't open the oven all the way. And so we'd been living there for about 6 months. We'd moved there so my husband could go to school on the GI Bill. And part of the deal is they pay your books and tuition and fees, but they also give you a monthly stipend to live on. So we'd moved there expecting that payment. Paperwork glitch happens. We don't get the payment. We have, you know, no jobs. So we'd gone to Burger King and gotten jobs there part-time each. And he was going to school and we were living in this apartment. And then the summer storms in Ohio are kind of torrential. And the landlord hadn't maintained the drains properly during a summer storm. And so, of course, we're in the lowest place in the building. The drains back up, ruin everything that we owned. And that was how I came to be living in a weekly motel, pregnant on WIC, which is a great backstory every time I start with. So I was pregnant living in a motel on WIC, and people start to get really judgmental about it. And I can go, well, here's how we wound up there. It's easier than you think, actually. Mm. You can be doing everything right and still wind up, you know, in that situation.
Wow. Did you, when you rented that apartment, did you feel like, wow, this is pretty bad?
No, because we'd started in the weekly motel. That had been the plan, was we're going to stay there for a week or two while we found a place. So it was kind of a relief to get into. And we never really saw it as more than a temporary stop because we figured the paperwork would kind of resolve itself in very short order. Mm. So we figured, well, this is, you know, not ideal, certainly, but we're in our 20s and technically he's a student. So, you know, we'll pretend that it's our 22-year-old student days, I guess, and feel like we're living our second youth. It was slightly more depressing than that, but you learn to kind of put the bright face on it where you can.
What's the worst place you ever rented?
I'm going to go with the attic. The attic was the worst place. There was just this busted up old place that it didn't really have seals on anything, so it was just sort of depending on the season, like you'd have just these amazing little bits of nature coming to live in your home to wake you up, like Cinderella's mice, if Cinderella's mice were roaches. It was actually one of the worst. I mean, I've got a friend right now that's renting a closet because that's all she can afford, and she lives in this closet, and she's built this fantastic, you know, triple decker bed, so she's got shelves underneath it, and it's mm-hmm. one of the most ingenious things I've ever seen. And if we could find a way to make that, you know, kind of a hoity-toity London property thing, I'm thinking we could probably make her a pretty penny in some of those higher housing markets.
So you said stuff would come into that attic apartment? Like what?
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is if you live in a poorly maintained building, you're going to get bugs and rodents and mice, and that's how nature does. They come in when it's warm to the warm places, and, you know, when it's hot outside, little living creatures will go to where it's cool naturally, and largely that's going to be whatever construction they have. So that stereotype we have of poor people, you know, being kind of dirty or unkempt or bad housekeepers, that's largely because the building maintenance is so expensive that you can't keep flies out, like, mm-hmm. in the middle of the summer. If you have any food at all inside ever, they're going to be attracted to, you know, anything you've got in your house. And if you have really great window sills and there's no cracks in your walls or in the joists or anything, then, you know, you're probably good to go. But if you're living in a building that's 50, 100 years old and hasn't really been well maintained over that past decade or so, give it up. Get the raid.
Where was this place?
Which one? The bugs?
Yeah.
Oh, it's all over the country. I mean, if you're in the Southwest, you're talking about silverfish. If you're in the, you know, and everywhere there's flies. If you're talking about the Midwest, then you're talking about little roaches. Roaches actually live all over the country, depending on where you are in the country. There's mm-hmm. different kinds. Bed bugs live absolutely everywhere across the country and are found on public transit. And once somebody in your building gets them, it's nearly impossible to get them out.
So
you know, it's everywhere.
Well, when you said nature coming in, I was thinking, which was the apartment you lived in where there was such a big hole in the, I thought it was in the roof, that a cat came in?
Oh, yeah, that was the attic. That was the attic. It was just, there was a place under the eaves that had, like, a big enough hole that you could have, like, rodents would live in the, like, eaves above the attic. And there's really nothing you can do to stop them except to trap them and get rid of them. So, you know, you do that. But it's you know, pretty common if you live in the country to live alongside little critters and animals that get in.
Did a cat come in?
Oh, yeah, dude, there was totally cats. There was totally cats up there, and one came down through the closet. And, you know, the thing is that isn't actually uncommon. That's not considered an unlivable situation if the rent is right, if the oven works, if the lights are on, if the plumbing works, and, you know, nothing's costing you too much. That's not the end of the world in the country to have a house like that. Plenty of people own their houses and have houses like that where the roof's coming in and they haven't had steady work in the last 15 or 20 years. Well, what do you put off? Is those big kind of prophylactic home maintenance purchases. You put those off until the very last possible second. And if the last possible second comes in a bad year when you've got nothing to go on with, well, you're going to have to live with it for a year or two until you get it fixed. I mean, and that is what rural poverty looks like. It's not just people who are renting places. This is, you know, what people live like when they don't have enough money to repair the places that they live in. Right. And that's a problem for homeowners and landlords, both. And what winds up happening is that your lower end rental market, which is where the folks that work, you know, in the service industry, and they work those low to wage jobs, we're in the low end of the rental market where it's pretty much take what you can get. If the utilities work, if all the appliances seem to work, if you don't feel like you're going to die, it's probably an all right place to live.
Did you try calling the landlord to say, hey, there are rats and now there's a cat just coming into my apartment?
Yeah, and they say, you know, look, that's you know, if you don't feel like it's a livable situation, you know, go ahead and move. You're on a month-to-month lease. But there's a reason the place is cheap enough that you can afford it. I mean, it ain't going for that low just because it's the kindness of the landlord's heart. It's because that's what people are willing to pay for it. And so when you're in that situation, if you're getting paid what people are willing to pay for your work, well, then you have to be willing to pay for the kind of housing you can afford. Mm-hmm. And you feel lucky to have a roof over your head. So the difference now, you know, I've been reflecting on this actually recently. I've been writing my next book, and it's been about a year and a half since Bill Maher officially welcomed me into the middle class on HBO, which I feel like there's the demarcation. And if I stayed at a hotel now that I had to check the mattresses for bed bugs, I would be pretty horrified. And it's only been in the last maybe 6 months that it hasn't occurred to me to check the Sheraton for bed bugs when somebody brings me out for a conference, because that's just the habit you get into. And those sorts of norms of what you expect livable versus comfortable to be are hugely disparate, largely because we have two tracks of housing in this country to the point where at one point in my life, and this is a couple of years ago, I would have been slightly annoyed to find rodents in a home that I was renting. And now, 3 years later, 2 years later, I would absolutely call the landlord and demand the problem be fixed by, like, tomorrow.
How did landlords treat you when you were living in places like the one you just described?
You know, largely, they're just making their money. Every now and again, you run into, you know, some really nice people that are making their money on the side. But largely, it's people who are businessmen, and they're the sort of business people who are marketing to the very poor and people with very unstable income sources. And so, you know, it's kind of it's rote, it's rude. They know largely that you don't really have other options. Like that apartment that I lived in Cincinnati, where it flooded, we wound up, because of the flood, and I'm talking a couple of feet up the walls. The landlord shop vac'd for a couple of days and then just sort of left the windows open in the middle of the late spring. So it got overheated and mold pretty much destroyed everything that the water hadn't gotten to. So we moved back into that same weekly motel we'd started in, but then we couldn't pay the rent. And we didn't realize you have to pay rent in escrow still if you want to withhold your rent from the landlord. We figured the apartment was unlivable, so we were just going to go, stay in the hotel because I was heavily pregnant at the time. And he sued for eviction after telling us that the apartment was absolutely livable. We'd had a health department come look at the place, and they told us that it wasn't, but it turns out it was the wrong health department. They didn't have jurisdiction over this exact address, so they couldn't do anything about it, and we couldn't reach the health inspector where there was. There's an attorney in Cincinnati. His name is John Treleaven, which I say on air whenever possible because this man is one of the best human beings I think I've ever met. He took our case with no money up front on the eviction and countersued for the circumstances we found ourselves in. And the landlord waited us out until we finally had to sign and say we'd drop our suit if he'd drop his so that we didn't have the eviction go on our records. But that is more normal than not.
Wow.
In my experience.
So not only are you coping with really substandard housing and a landlord who's the opposite of helpful and who's trying to sue you, and then an incredible paperwork runaround trying to get any kind of services or help, and in the end, you don't recoup any of your money, you've lost all your money, and the only thing you can be grateful for is that now you don't have a record of eviction.
Yeah, because that would have been the worst thing. Like, if you can avoid having an eviction on your credit, like, you can find housing. But if you have an eviction in the last, I don't know, five or six years, you can pretty much forget it. Somebody else is going to have to sign your lease for you. So then that's a whole nother step. I mean, and something like that is only one way to get evicted, too. If you live in public housing in a lot of places, having a family member who's been convicted of any crime, even down to a petty misdemeanor, is enough to get you kicked out of public housing unless you ban that relative from ever stepping foot in your house again. And that might be your child, your brother, you know, whatever. You can get evicted because the landlord thinks that you have too many children and they don't like children on their property. So if you have another child, you might get evicted for that because this is private property and they can decide who they rent to. The laws are largely written to protect landlords and not renters. And again, these are the sorts of people that, you know, really don't have access to attorneys or an understanding of what their rights under the law are anyway.
Now, I was really struck reading your book by how much power the landlords have over their low-income tenants.
I have had landlords offer to lower my rent in exchange for certain services, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, and it wasn't that implicit. You know, I've seen people try to offer people free rent in exchange for full-time unpaid work. I had to take a deal like that once. I was working 90-hour weeks and I didn't have any bills to pay, sure, but I didn't have any money either. Those sorts of situations are not uncommon because what you're dealing with is essentially a bunch of people who have lives so unstable that no reputable company is willing to take risks. And it's not to say necessarily like, oh, we think you're a bad credit risk because we think you're a terrible person. It's we think you're a bad credit risk because we have made so many millions of people's lives so predictably unpredictable that we can't actually serve you. And that is the trap that we get into. So the more unstable your housing is, the more unstable everything else gets. I was in Washington, D.C. a couple of days ago, and they actually cleared out an encampment of folks that had been sleeping in these tents. And they were, like, crushing the tents in the trash compactor right in front of them. Mm-hmm. And where are those folks supposed to go? How are social services supposed to reach them when they had at least a place they were staying? And now you have no address. Well, the homeless don't vote. They're not allowed to. You've got to have, you know, a place to register an address for. You can't get an ID without an address. Find me a person that can get a job and a phone contract and get back on their feet with no real address. And so that's kind of how basic housing is. And for anybody that's on that precarious Sedge, it is as all-consuming as anything else could possibly be of how do I get myself into a more stable housing situation? And even if you're in one, is there a better one? Can I move like 5 miles closer to work? I don't know. How likely am I to keep this job for very long? Is it worth that kind of transition? And that whole thing, it's a constant drumbeat of how do you get that little tiny bit more ahead?
Was there ever a point where you felt like you were home, where you felt secure enough that you could put down roots, plan a little bit for the future?
No. 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 Because, I mean, you have to realize where I came in economically as well. I graduated high school in 1999, so I initially, as an adult in the economy, hit 9/11, and then it was 2008. And in those years, you either made it up front or you didn't. Those were your options, and I hadn't. And so there wasn't really any point putting down roots until we figured out what was going to come next. You know, everybody's saying the service industry is going to be wiped out by globalization and robotics, and we've got all of these other things coming up, and nobody knows what the American workforce is going to look like in 5 or 10 years. So there didn't seem really at any point during my 20s any point putting down roots, because the second I did, it was just as likely, you know, something else was going to happen that was huge and impactful. It seemed better to stay flexible.
You know, it sounds physically and financially so unstable, but it also sounds exhausting.
Yes. 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 So the studies that we've done actually tell us what happens when your brain is under that much stress all the time, because what it is the information is so constant and the data sets that you have to work with are shifting so constantly that it actually takes brain capacity to be poor on a level that you just never think of in the middle classes. Like, what are gas prices today at each of the gas stations that I went past if I'm a waitress, so that I can think of how much I made in tips, how much I can put in the tank, and how many miles that's going to get me until my next shift. That's a calculation I would make every day when I was a waitress. And so all of those things. And it actually decreases your brain capacity to make other normal life decisions. And so when that is what you're struggling against, and you know that it's your job to bootstrap your way up, and you actually not only have to go to work and raise your children, but you also need to be improving yourself and trying to get that next rung up the ladder. So you're putting yourself through school, plus you're thinking, okay, which gas station had gas at what price? And what's OPEC doing? Like, should I be really filling my tank this week? Because next week it might be cheaper, or next week it might be prohibitively expensive. And that is the kind of exhaustion, like where your brain just started spinning, where I'm trying to explain it. That's what it is. It's just constant all the time. And you never get enough physical sleep to catch up from your physically demanding job that you're doing either.
You said you've got a couple of kids. How did this affect the way you parented?
Well, I mean, obviously you're not going to be the parent that you dreamed of being, are you? It makes your personality a little flatter. And that's going to show through in everything. Another study that they've done is if you perform happiness for a living, it decreases your ability to actually honestly feel any, because you train your brain into not getting that chemical and not associating the chemical with this feeling that you're creating in yourself. And so I think that would be the biggest impact.
So if you go to work and you're in a service job and you've got to smile and say, you know, would you like fries with that all day long, it's gonna be harder for you to feel pleasure in other people's company?
Yeah, because it's not the words that matter. When I was working fast food and I was working the front counter, I would get complaints when people didn't feel that I meant the words enough. It was never what I said. It was that they felt I wasn't coming along with them far enough. And so then you have to actually pretend to the level that everybody around you feels as though you really are grateful to be there. And if you stop and pay attention, actually, drive past fast food places when you notice hiring signs, and they'll say, now hiring friendly, smiling faces. Mm-hmm. all of the service jobs, you know, we need you to have a great attitude. We want you to be happy to be here. We need you to be super excited to serve the customer. And that's a great requirement for a job. And I understand why they have that. But what it does to the worker is make it less make them less capable of honestly ever feeling happiness. And so then you have these houses where we're trying to teach our children how to be whole human beings, but we're also having to try to teach them how to live the lives that we're living, because we know that mobility is actually kind of decreasing a little bit when it comes to that. And we know what reality is. So, you know, it's not undepressing to be poor in America, let's put it that way. But the hope that we always have for the future is that my children talk about history, and my children talk about art, and my children, you know, talk about science. They learned about science, and photosynthesis is, you know, when plants grow because we take pictures of them, which I think is fantastic 5-year-old logic. And if your 5-year-old is coming up with stuff like that and can spell her name and is excited to learn, then are you really doing that bad of a job at the end of the day? You know, and I think that that's what I try to tell people when we talk about parenting, is that what counts with your children at the end of the day is not that you are comfortable enough to be your best self with them, although it would be great if we could figure that out for millions of Americans. It's that your children feel loved and stimulated and as though they have room to grow. And that can happen in any home, and that cannot happen in any home, from the biggest to the smallest. So I think that when it comes to parenting, yeah, it doesn't help. But the things that you can't give them aren't things that you can't teach them to find. Right. And I think that that's the thing that counts at the end of the day.
You were talking about happiness, and I'm struck by remembering at one point you actually taught yourself a different way to smile. You want to talk about why?
Oh, yeah. So I had I was in a car accident when I was younger, about a decade or so ago, and the guy was uninsured and really high and super drunk and speeding through a red light, and we T-boned him, and my jaw hit the dashboard. And I didn't understand insurance companies, so I took the settlement thinking that that was for the car, not realizing that indemnified them for medical. And of course, I was medically uninsured. So when it turns out that a bunch of my teeth had cracked, nobody could do anything about it. And I could never afford to do anything about it, because even if you get Medicaid, that doesn't cover dental, which is still true under a lot of Obamacare plans. And so, you know, after years, it doesn't matter, you know, how much you floss or you brush. If you've got cracked teeth, you're going to get cavities. And if you get cavities, they're going to spread. And that's how dentistry and science and biology and anatomy work. And, you know, after a while, you start to realize that this is, you know, a hugely embarrassing thing in American society, of like, we don't want you to have access to ways to fix it, but we are going to blame you for not having done so. And I think you'll find, if you ask your readers to email in from blind email addresses where they can't be identified, how many of them have ever not eaten foods that they would have liked to order publicly because they, you know, knew it would hurt them, or have learned to laugh covering their mouths with their hands, or speak with their teeth covered with their lips at all times. You know, and I think you'll find you get a bit of a deluge, because it's one of the things that people ask me about privately most frequently, and say, you know, I didn't even realize so many people had it. But the more I talk about it, the more I realize that there are way more people than I thought that are in kind of crippling pain every day and just not saying anything, because what are you going to do about it? I mean, I killed an entire bottle of vodka in one night, and I don't even drink, and I didn't feel drunk. Like, that's the worst of it.
We also judge people on their experience. Did you lose jobs because of the way your teeth looked?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It actually is the reason that I wound up in fast food. I had started out of college. I dropped out of college. Started school when I was 16. Don't do that, kids. You're not ready yet. Did about as well as you expect a 16-year-old to do, right? And I picked up a couple of jobs in field organizing, and I really liked it. But find me a politician where shiny white teeth isn't the actual first job descriptor, right? And it doesn't matter how good you are if they can't put you out in front of the cameras and they can't put you out in front of the voters and you're not, you know, an accurate reflection of the picture of America that they want the voters to see. And actually, the nation wound up having to debunk the rumor that it had never derailed my career. So now we have it on record of people saying, yeah, that was actually why she couldn't find work, is it had nothing to do with her talent, skill, or potential, and everything to do with the fact that a drunk driver had hit her and she was uninsured, and anatomy is going to continue to be anatomy no matter how much meritocracy we shove into America.
So why do you think that the experience of poverty that you're describing, which is millions of people live with this kind of poverty in America, why do you think it is so invisible to people who don't live in it?
Because we've very, very intentionally made it so. I mean, you don't have Burger Kings in the sorts of places where dinner costs $15. And the people making the decisions in America pay $15 for lunch. And that's how it goes. You know, you're not going to get a service worker telling you at their job when you interact with them, hey, do you know what my life is like when I'm not here? Because their job is to smile and be grateful and happy to see you. That is what they do for a living. And most people do it really, really well. And so then you've got the middle and upper classes interacting with the service industry and the working classes only ever when they're bright and shiny and happy. And they don't ever stop to think about, you know, I don't think I've ever gone when these folks are off work to talk to them. Nobody rides the bus. Nobody rides the bus. And maybe ride the metro. It's interesting, in the TV show Scandal, actually, there was a plot point that hinged on Olivia, the main character, running across this other main character in the metro, and he was huddled and homeless. And I've been in D.C. often enough now to think, that would actually never happen. You're never going to find a scruffy guy in a dirty blanket sitting in a D.C. metro station. This is a place where in Anacostia, they can't get their trash picked up. But you go over the river into Virginia and they have solar powered trash compactors. And that's the class divide in America. We have moved into our own neighborhoods. We have moved into there's in New York City a housing complex that's largely luxury condos. And then there's the required amount of low income housing. And they actually have separate doors so that the poor people wouldn't be using any of the concierge services that the wealthy people were paying for. They called it the poor door. That sort of thing is so common in America, and we don't know it, and so we don't know how disengaged we are. But then if the only time you run into working class folks, we're either shiny and happy because we're being paid money, or we're bitter and angry and disaffected, you're not really going to engage with that either. And so, you know, there's this kind of, well, what do you do? And it's why I tell horrific stories of my life and I try to make as many jokes as possible, because it's the only way that you can really talk about it without it being like, well, you know, what now?
So sweetening the medicine.
That, and it's how you survive. I mean, look, hope is a thing that doesn't actually make a whole lot of sense if it looks like your future is going to be Burger King, right? Like, if you think that that's what the rest of your life is probably going to be, hope's not awesome, really mentally healthy for you. But jokes are a way that you can say, we have this shared experience. It's not just us. This is, you know, humanity, nasty, brutish, and short, right? Ha, ha, ha. And you get through it that way. And I think you'll find that in any industry, in any group of people that have to face reality too much, you'll find that same kind of bonding humor.
So you got out eventually. I mean, this epic story of, you know, you wrote a personal essay, a blog post that wound up going viral on the internet. You wound up with a book deal and your life has changed a lot. You live in much better places now than, you know, that attic apartment. Do you now feel like a member of the middle class, or are there ways in which...
Oh, I hope not.
I was going to ask, are there ways in which you still feel poor?
It's such a difficult question. No, I never feel poor. And it's because nothing is ever going to be that bad ever again. Like, dude, my bills are paid for the next couple of months at least, no matter how bad it ever gets again. And even if it ever got that bad again, man, I got a vacation. That is more than most. Like, it's you can't change that, I think. As far as feeling middle class, I don't actually know what that means yet, because the middle class seem to be the only people that really define themselves by how much money they have. The very rich seem to be kind of above it all, and people with no money don't have the luxury. So I've never had to define myself by how much money I had. Other people tried that, and I kind of went, well, that's not how I roll. So I don't know what it means.
Well, you had a pretty knee-jerk response right there. You said, you know, oh, I hope not. How come?
I don't really ever want to be defined by my earning power bank account, because that is way too fungible a measure of somebody's worth. Like, look, dude, I didn't go to university overnight. I didn't become suddenly more educated. I didn't actually do anything except for exist. And then between this one week and the next, here you are, you know, kind of a bad employee because you can't keep your mouth shut, versus you're like an internationally noted social critic with some intellectual value. And nothing that I had done, nothing changed for me. So when that's the reality that you confront, and you look at all of these pressures that we put on people, and we look at the way that we define people, and you're like, you guys do realize that none of it is a thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm living proof that it's only a thing because we've made it so. And when that's what you're looking at, it becomes a lot harder. I guess the thing I push back against really strongly is, I hope I haven't changed that much. I hope I haven't become anything. I would like to think that I know more and that I have a broader experience, but I think I would like to think that I haven't lost what it was that I was fighting for or against in the first place.
Linda, thanks. Thanks a lot for talking.
Absolutely. Thank you.